question on your topics.
You've got it, Joe. Wait for the beeps and go ahead with your question.
Beach 4YY. I've been curious about this one for a while. I gave you both a disc on, a copy of disc of the shuttle launch from July 2011. I think both of you by now have probably watched it. Am I correct on that? Answer that first before I proceed.
I saw it. It was great.
I haven't seen it yet, but okay. Yeah. Go ahead with your question for Paul. You got it, Joe.
You haven't seen it yet. You can't rush into these things, you know. Okay, Paul, since you've watched it, it was great. Did you notice when they finally went to the launch sequence at 30 seconds, you know, counting down, that the engines fire, and if you watch the whole thing, like about 20 or 30 minutes before the actual launch, you watch them doing like the nozzle steering check, and you can see the motors just, you know, swivel, go this way, go that way, along a different axis to check to see if the movement. When the engines are actually firing, they fire at about 10 seconds or so, and in about 2 seconds, you actually see them change the orientation before they actually fully ignite and let the thing go. I wonder why that is. I wonder why they're not pre-positioned all the time at one position where they have to be, instead of positioned like about 2 seconds before the launch actually lets go off the band. Back to you, Paul.
And they have a home position, but then at launch they move it at the last second because they want the exhaust not to. They don't want to have the exhaust favoring the where the rocket starts going toward the launch complex. It has to do with that. I know that. So they have a regular home location, one position, and that's where it's going to stay in case there's an abort, and they'll shut it down. But if they decide to go, they'll move it at that last second. Yeah, I've seen that before. Back to you, John.
Okay, I thought it had something to do with exact balancing, because it makes you wonder how balanced this thing is, because you're trying to lift a couple of million pounds of something off the ground. And initially, it's only moving a couple of feet per second, and initially, you know, starts letting go off the pad. It's not moving very fast, and eventually it picks up speed. It's going pretty fast by the time it clears the top of the tower. It's already got this trajectory, and, you know, it's guided, or, you know, helped, I guess, some of the other steering rockets self-guided. But in that first couple of seconds, it must be a real challenge to keep this thing aligned perfectly straight up so it doesn't, like, so to speak, fall over on itself.
Yeah. I know they always worry about the thing going toward the launch complex. And that's why with the winds, if the winds are going one way, they're okay. But if the winds are going the other way, at a certain speed, they'll scrub the launch. You know, once you scrub the launch pad, you can move that thing. You know, one little breeze, and you can move the whole thing toward the launch complex. I know that's a problem. And also the solid booster motors are actually actuated to some degree. They have 6 degrees one way or the other. You think they would be in one position, but they can actually be moved, and they are moved as they go up, and they go into a roll position. And the next time we see that go up, the last time we saw a solid booster go up was the Ares test vehicle. They were eventually going to use this to launch people up, and then that got canceled right after Obama got into office, and then they went with the SLS program, and the solid boosters that are being developed now are, you know, there were four pieces stacked on top of one another, four segments for each solid booster on the shelf. Now they have five. So it's going to have a lot more thrust for a longer period of time. Each one is going to have 3.5 million pounds of thrust, total of 7 million pounds of thrust. And the engines, those same engines that you're talking about, Joe, are now, they saved them from the shuttle time, and they're putting them on the new SLS, the exact same engines, except, you know, reworked a little bit to create more horsepower. back to you, I guess.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, very good. I had nothing else. I'm just kind of curious about that one particular thing I noticed. I replayed it a couple of times, and you know, just to see what I was looking at. Then they definitely do steer in a particular direction before the thing likes let's go. But I guess I can understand what you're talking about them being in a home position. So it's still interesting to watch that thing go up. Now the next series of manned space flights are going to be using a vehicle similar to the shuttle, completely different. It's not going to. Apparently it's going to use booster rockets, but no huge external fuel tank to go with it, too.
Yeah, you're going to have an external fuel tank, a little bit bigger than the shuttle. But here's what you do. Take the external fuel tank from the shuttle, put an Orion spacecraft on top of the fuel tank. Take four of these engines. Remember, the shuttle had three RS-25 engines, they call it. Take four RS-25 engines, put them on the bottom of the fuel tank. Take two solid booster rockets, put one on the port side, one on the starboard side, and attach it, put people on the top and light this big candle. That's what you got, Joe.
So they're launching this whole huge monstrosity into space. As one piece, I guess, except minus the booster rockets.
Well, the booster rockets are going to help launch the whole system. You got an external tank, which is this big orange contraption. On the bottom of the tank, you put the four engines. On the left-hand side of the tank, you put a solid booster rocket, except a bigger one than they use for the space shuttle. And on the right-hand side, put another one. And then on the top of this external fuel tank, which is carrying all the oxygen, liquid hydrogen, you put the Orion spacecraft. So yeah, no, and this whole thing is going to be going up 9.5 million pounds of thrust, and you'll see this in end of 2018. First one is an unmanned launch. They're going to send it out past the moon, about 40,000 miles past the moon, and then bring it back. And then eventually, a couple of years after that, you'll see the same thing go up, except with people. Dick, over to you.
The way you described that, Paul, it looks like everything is one stage. This isn't a multi-stage rocket. Go ahead.
Yeah, you got to think like the... You got to think like the Russians, you know. The two boosters is really the first stage, you know. And then when they drop off, they would consider like the four RS-25 engines the second stage. On the top of that, you have just one rocket for your second stage. That's made by Aerojet, and that's also a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. I forgot how many pounds of thrust that is. Well, that's the one that's attached to the Orion spacecraft, and eventually they'll eventually lose that on the way back from the moon, and then you'll just have the Orion spacecraft coming back and landing in the Pacific Ocean, similar to what you had with Apollo back in there.
In the case of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, you had an escape tower of three little rockets sitting up above the capsule, which gets jettisoned later on, but that has the ability to take the astronaut with their capsule and lifting them away from everything else if something goes wrong. Will this new 9.5 million pound vehicle you're describing, will it have a similar escape tower on top of the crew capsule? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, that part is built by Orbital ATK. Yeah, this in the launch abort system. LAS. You really have two types. You have the tractor type and the pusher type. The tractor type is the ones that we're all familiar with. On top of Mercury, it would pull the spacecraft away to safety. Gemini didn't have it. Gemini had ejection seats. That's what they depended on. The Apollo had the tractor pulling type as well, and that would pull the spacecraft away from the from a malfunctioning Saturn V rocket. Now you have the pusher types that have been developed by actually three companies. One is Blue Origin. Just a few months ago, they had a test of that rocket. The New Shepard goes up, the crew capsule gets pushed away. It has a one rocket mounted in the center that pushes it away from the exploding rocket. And the same with different rockets. So let me drop it. The same type of system, pusher system as well for Dragon. Dragon has, they call them Super Draco engines. Super Draco engines, each one delivers, I think it's, 15,000 pounds of thrust. Yeah, 15, 30, some number like that. And you have a total of 8 of them. So at 4 corners of the Dragon spacecraft, you have, you know, 2 rockets, 2 Super Dracos each. So actually, it's built for redundancy. In case one fails, the other one takes over. So you're going to have a total of 8 rockets. So if you're going up and there's a problem, it would push the whole spacecraft, Dragon spacecraft, away from the Falcon 9. And they plan on using that for propulsive landings as well in the future, instead of coming back on a parachute with people. Let me drop it. With cargo, they're going to use this for cargo eventually too. Instead of coming back with parachutes, they're going to come through the atmosphere, retro rockets, and then use these propulsive Super Draco engines that they would have normally used for an emergency. They're going to use them to come back and eventually land on land. So that's a SpaceX launch abort system. And then well, so we got Boeing. Boeing is going to have this similar type of thing. They have a pusher type of setup, different engines. They'll be able to push the Starliner away from an exploding Atlas V rocket. And then you come to Orion, the new one, and like I said, that has the biggest launch abort system going. And that's going to be attached to the Orion. That's a tractor type. We'll pull it away. And by the way, the Soyuz spacecraft, the ones that they launch in Russia, also have the tractor type that pulls would pull the Soyuz away from the exploding rocket. Back to you there.
In the case of the tractor type launch abort system, somewhere during the boost phase, you know you're not going to use it anymore, and therefore you jettison it, and therefore the payload becomes a lot lighter. In the case of the pusher-type launch abort system, you can't jettison that rocket engine. You're going to carry it all the way with all that extra payload. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, Dragon wants to do that because their goal is to eventually use that to come back to Earth without parachutes. So it's not going to go to waste for them. For Boeing, it would go to waste. And for Blue Origin, for their suborbital flights, it really doesn't matter. They're only going to go up to 100 kilometers and separate and come back down and land on parachutes. So no big deal for them. So, yeah. And then, you know, if you look at the orbital ATK system for the SLS, for the Space Launch System, they have four main rockets that would pull the whole setup away. Solid booster rockets is really what it is. They're solid rockets, not boosters, but solid rockets that would pull the whole thing away. And then, naturally, when they they're in space and they don't need those, there's other ones near the top that actually pull the cover away. You don't pull the whole spacecraft. The spacecraft stays attached, but it pulls the top cover and the whole launch abort system completely away from the Orion spacecraft. And then there's another rocket on the very, very top. Let me drop it. That if that's ignited, they have 8 valves. Let's call them valves. The shutters that kind of like open and close. There's eight of these openings, one rocket. And they use that for maneuvering. Let's say there was an abort, and the big four rockets light, and it pulls the whole spacecraft and people away from the exploding rocket down below to adjust the attitude and, you know, make sure this thing doesn't go in the direction that they want. You know, they want to keep it upright because eventually they're going to have parachutes come out of this thing. They have this one rocket light with all these different, like, little doors that open and close, little valves that open and close, eight of them near the top, depending on which direction the computer tells it. You know, if it's starting to pitch over one way, it'll compensate. It's a big complicated scheme with these tractor systems. I think they're pretty complicated what SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Boeing have. Back to you.
The tractor type launch abort system, I think I can see how you use it. The pusher type, I see a problem. One, you're carrying it with you all the way, or the pusher rocket could be used later on as the third stage of boost. But you said the pusher type can be used as a rocket landing. Okay, if I'm bringing the capsule back down, I need a heat shield when I first hit the atmosphere. And the pusher-type rocket right in the back of the capsule is in the way of that heat shield. So having the heat shield for atmosphere reentry and then using the pusher-type abort system as a landing rocket, gee, that sounds like a tough way to go. I'm having trouble seeing how you use that. Over you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, that's why Blue Origin, which is suborbital, only uses the one. They don't need the heat shield as they're coming down. You know, they're not coming down, you know, like coming back from the moon at 25,000 miles an hour. We're coming back from an orbit at 17,500. They're just coming back from, you know, maybe a 5,000 mile an hour trip. Heat shield is not that important for Blue Origin. So they have the one rocket mounted in the center. But the other two, Dragon and the Starliner. Starliner is being built by Boeing, Dragon by SpaceX. Has, for instance, SpaceX has 8 of these rockets. They're super Draco rockets. They call them Super Dracos because they have 25 thrusters normally on their Dragon spacecraft. And these are regular thrusters that they use in space to move the spacecraft around. These are reaction control systems. And they call them Draco engines. Now they made Super Draco engines, which are really powerful. And they've tested this, by the way. I've seen it on a... They've actually tested it on a pad for an emergency. Let me drop it. They had a full-size Dragon in the... It was at Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral. And they lit these 8 engines off from the pad, and this thing took off like I can't believe it. And it took off and went a mile or two out to the ocean. Parachutes open. Everything worked perfectly. If there was anybody in there, they would have survived. So these rockets come out on the side. You know, so you still have your heat shield, a complete heat shield, but off to the side, located around the circumference of the spacecraft is, you know, you have two in one, let's call it one corner, two in another. So you have 4 sets of these Super Draco engines, and they could be adjusted. They could, you know, one could go more thrust than the other, you know. So that's how they get their ability to retain their attitude after they separated from a exploding spacecraft. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
In the case of the pusher-type launch abort system, and you're going to come back and land on that rocket, I see a couple of problems here. One, are there some legs that come down alongside of that rocket so that that's your landing pad? And number two, if that rocket doesn't fire just right, you're going to come down awful fast, you're going to wish you had parachutes. The nice thing about parachutes is you deploy three of them, and if one of them doesn't inflate and you land on the two, that's not so bad. You got some kind of redundancy there. But if you're landing on this pusher launch abort system rocket, and if it doesn't fire just right, I don't see an easy backup on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, apparently these engines have been tested thousands of times, and they know they're going to light. So, also what they have planned is, now they're not building, right now they have contracts for cargo flights going up to the International Space Station. This is SpaceX. They're going to have new ones being built that are a little different, and the new ones are going to have the Super Draco engines in them, where the old ones didn't have it. So he's got plans on bringing cargo back from the space station without parachutes, using these Super Draco engines, naturally with no people. So he'll probably do this dozens of times, that's my guess, so it's probably many years down the road before he attempts to bring people back with this. But that's his ultimate goal. When he first starts bringing astronauts back from the space station, he's coming down on parachutes, just like he's doing now with the cargo. Cargo is coming down on parachutes, landing in the ocean. So we're a ways from that, and I'm just giving you an idea of what he's got planned. And as far as landing, you know, with the feet, yeah, he can separate the bottom of the, it looks like he's got the bottom of the heat shield, he's 4 feet come out of it somehow. It's a strange setup. It's not like the Russians where the whole heat shield pops off and then they, you know, he doesn't have that design. His feet are somehow incorporated into the heat shield. We'll see what happens.
The engine sits in front of that heat shield, Paul. Go ahead.
With SpaceX, to the side. Could you imagine, like a cone, you know, that's what a capsule looks like, you know. Can you imagine coming down on angles? If the exhaust goes out, they're going out on an angle, like a 30-degree angle. I'm not sure the angle it's going. But it's not coming down straight. And they're all pitched, you know, maybe, you know, I'm going to say 15, 20 degrees, not 30 degrees. But, you know, they're pitched to the side. You got to get a close-up look at these the Crew Dragon. They call it the Crew Dragon. Looks like the Cargo Dragon, except it's got a big door for people.
Earlier tonight, you talked about a small amount of steerability of a solid rocket booster. Now, a good-sized solid rocket booster is something like 1 million pounds of thrust, and it's, in the case of your description of it mounted to a external tank, that mounting is a very strong mounting, and you're not going to move that very much. So therefore, the steerability of a solid rocket booster, is that a little bit of steerability of the nose, of the exhaust cone, whatever you're going to call it, or is there a vane in the exhaust that can be steered? How do you steer a solid rocket booster? Over to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Apparently, they have some kind of hydraulics moving that because they said that they tested it at Promontory, Utah, where they test these things. And they ran a test, fired the whole thing, and that shit didn't go anywhere. It's laying down horizontally. And part of the test was to, you know, make sure this thing actuated, and they can go one way or the other, 6 degrees. How that's accomplished, I don't know yet. India has a strange way of doing it. They have solid boosters too. and they introduce some other chemical, I forget what it is, it's in these tanks, and by introducing it to the side of the exhaust, apparently it changes the way it's burning, and that's how they get their pitch. A very strange setup, but that's the way they do it, by introducing another chemical to a certain part of the exhaust as it's coming out. Some complicated scheme. That's how they get their pitch.
So they're modulating the magnitude of the thrust, but the hydraulics you're talking about, is that moving the exhaust nozzle, steering it a little bit? I'm having trouble believing that the whole darn million-pound thrust solid rocket booster, I'm having trouble believing that the whole booster is moving with reference to the external tank that it's attached to. Over you, Paul.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't actually see it move, so I'm just going by the one engineer that was talking. You know, he interviewed these people, and the guy was saying that they had 6 degrees of thrust. So, but I haven't seen how it's done yet. Back to you, Dick. We're running out of time.
Yeah, we're out of time. Stand by. So that was TechNet number 1634. That was Space Report 234A and 234B. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. And back to you, Paul, for any final comments. Be kind to each other. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. Hope 2017 is good for everybody, and I hope John makes it back shortly. 73 guys, have a good have a very good week, and we'll catch you next week. WS2N is clear. Back to you, Dick, if you have anything further.
This is AC2IS with info on rockets.
Go ahead. There are still people listening.
I guess my apologies. Falling asleep on TechNet, but I woke up to hear a little bit of Dick asking questions about rockets, and I think he was asking about the fuel system and the scheme of pushing the propellants into the nozzle by early mixing very small quantities of oxygen and propellant, AC2IS.
Is there anything else that you would like to add up to the discussion? It is interesting what you're saying, but I'm trying to find out what is a difference between the ionic thrust. At the trust that was described by you.
This is AC2IS. Because I was just waking up to this, maybe I misunderstood what they were talking about, but I thought they were talking about what's become sort of the standard NASA rocket engines, and also what SpaceX, the same kind of technology that SpaceX is using. It used to be that there were different systems that ran pumps that pushed oxygen towards the nozzle and systems that pushed propellant towards the nozzle. And those were fueled in different ways. But nowadays what they do is they take in order to run the pump to get oxygen to the nozzle, they'll take their actual oxygen supply and add just a little bit of propellant in order to power those pumps. And they'll take their propellant, to run the propellant pumps, they'll run just a little bit of oxygen to power the propellant pumps. I thought that's what Dick was asking about, and I believe those systems do not redirect or vector the thrust by tilting the nozzle, but that the nozzles are gimbaled. I believe those are, there's a different system to move the nozzles, AC to IS. Yes, I'm assuming that since TechNet just signed off, it's just after midnight, and yeah, those guys may have shut their radios down already. But yeah, you know, the other part of the question there was, you know, are the nozzles, you know, for the thrust vectoring, do they actually move the nozzles? I believe they do. I believe the nozzles are gimbaled. But that's how they get their thrust vectoring, that they actually have motors that move the nozzles back and forth in order to get their thrust vectoring, AC2IS. I'm not an authority on these types of information, and also there are different rocket systems. I'm not 100% sure I think SpaceX also has separate thrusters, kind of like a bow thruster on a boat that's landing on those barges. They get a little side to side thrust vectoring that's not part of the main thruster at the bottom of the rocket, AC2IS. Wow, if that's what they were talking about, geez, I thought they were talking about rockets. But if we're talking about those extremely low frequency systems to communicate with submarines, I wouldn't know what the ionosphere has to do about it. As far as I understand, that's it's really for communicating with submarines under the sea. That's sort of a ground wave propagation thing that would have very little to do with the ionosphere. I'm thinking that these are very low frequencies. They should pass right through the ionosphere and keep on going out into space, but I could be wrong about that. But also, I think there's very little information that they need to communicate with those signals. As far as I understand it, those signals are only exist in order to tell submarines when they need to come to the surface to communicate. At the most, those things might need to communicate the name or number of a submarine to tell them which one needs to come to the surface for further information. And also, I was wondering if there was some discussion on TechNet about gravity waves, since that seems to be in the news lately. AC2IS.
12:22 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 12:22 a.m.
Amateur radio newsline report number 2045 for the release date of Friday, January 6th, 2017, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The International Space Station finds help for its VHF radio crisis. American Indians get on the air for their first ever net. And are you ready for winter field day? All...
The time is 12:23 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL Repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, WQVL repeater system.
Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the WQVL repeater.
W on portable.
KTKW, this is KTKND.
Morning, Dennis here. How you doing on this brisk morning?
I'm inside nice and warm, not bothering me at all. But taking you outside.
Right into the office. And it is brisk. My advice to you is if you're inside, you don't have to go out, stay in.
I did go out to get the newspaper at the curb, and it was it is bitter cold out there. No argument there. Where are you at? Because you are breaking up a little bit into the repeater.
Yes, copy that. I'm on an HT rubber ducky inside my vehicle, so I'm probably going to lose you soon. I'm getting out of range of the repeater. Anyway, I just wanted a quick chat. 7-3, and catch up with you later. KD2LYW, all clear.
All right, 7-3, have a great day. Drive carefully. This is K2KNB.
N2EO, it's you, Mike Bravo.
Oh, Barry. N2MB, N2EO, I see you home.
I've only been home about an hour. As soon as I got to the house, Annie showed up. I got to take her a couple of places. She got a doctor's appointment and stuff like that. So now I'm doing daddy dues. I don't mind. That's fine by me. I'm cool with that. But I've been home. I got home at just about 7 o'clock. I didn't even get a chance. All I did was change my shirt. That was it. I was out the door again. And I've been traveling since 2 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday.
You must be tired. Do you think you could put that order in today? You want to do it tomorrow?
Got to get to the bank first. I can't put the order until I get to the bank. So let's see if I can do that during the day today.
Hey, buddy, good enough. I'm glad you're back. I missed you.
Okay, and I get the latest. Well, I pretty much, I talk to you all the time, so. Okay, Annie's going to be, she's in the laundromat right now, and she's coming out. So we're going to get coffee together. I haven't had any coffee, I haven't had any of it. I've been traveling on a bouncy bus all night, so I really got to get a cup of coffee and sit down for a minute. Here she comes. Okay, let's say hello to Annie, and then I'm going to shut down.
Okay, hi.
Okay, I'll see you in a little bit, Rich. N2EO and 2MV.
Real quick, Barry, did you stop and have anything to eat?
Oh, no, not yet. I'm going to do that right now, I guess, right? Yeah, I'm going to go have some coffee with my daughter. And that's where I'm going right now. So I'm going to sit down in a couple of seconds and have a cup of coffee and who knows what. And I'll be good to go for the day. You know me already.
I know, Barry. All right, I'll catch you later. Now, like I've said before, you're not allowed to croak. I won't allow it.
I'm mighty glad you said that. Okay, I'll see you in a bit. N2EO and 2MB, Rockaway Beach.
Okay, Barry. See you later. Give me a call on the telephone. If you get a chance, I have something to tell you. Not for the radio. N2MB and 2EO.
Okay, in a little while, I will do just that. And 2MB clear.
K2KMB, WBTCSE.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good morning. Did you get my voicemail?
You know what? I didn't have a chance to look at much. That was when? That was yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday late in the day. Something I thought you'd get a chuck ladder. I heard it. I looked it up because I was trying to figure out where the call came from. Somewhat unusual.
I'll take a look at it. When I got home from HRU yesterday, I just took out my cell phone and put it in the cradle to recharge. I saw it quickly and I just didn't have a chance, and I'll take a look at it. Anyway, the wires
help, very descriptive. The hard line is certainly interesting. The Helix and the that RG-400, whose number I finally got straight.
LMR-400. Yeah, I think that. I forget. No, that was his comment. That was, I think it might have been another manufacturer, but I don't remember it anymore.
Yeah, but anyway, it was good. HIU was fine yesterday. I think there was over 200, maybe 250 people, something like that. Considering the weather and the parking lot really didn't get cleared until later in the day. Well, not later in the day, but, you know, by the time people were already coming in. So it was good. And the guest speaker was Tom Gallagher, the CEO of the ARRL, and he spoke on a timely subject to changes necessary in the ARRL to make it viable. Anyway, it was good. And now I'm going to have to go out and run the snowblower for the snow that I didn't clear because I was up so early yesterday morning.
You poor fella.
Sound like you're gonna have to invest in Dayquil also. you really sound bad, Rich.
Yeah, but that's for my voice. That's great. You know, when I'm down in the basso profundo range, or there, so thereabouts, as opposed to being up in the double tenor range. At least I sound like I'm significant here. Good morning, Jerry. How are you?
Good morning, Rich. Good morning, Steve. I'm glad everybody had a good time yesterday. That's always a nice thing to hear, that it was successful, even though you were there, Rich. But it didn't spoil anything. I could see that. Steve?
I detect the note of sarcasm in his voice.
Me?
Gary?
Lots of sarcasm.
Gary says it as it is, and what's the rest of that? Says it as it is, and is it as it says. Something like that. I don't know. Jerry?
Hey, you guys continue with yourself. Yeah, you really sound like you got a cold. I didn't think you had that much snow, but you needed a snow thrower. But I guess it varied from area to area. Steve?
Yes, it does. Probably got about 6 inches or so, 6 or 8 inches out here. And I know it was heavier a little bit further east. I don't know. How about you, Rich? You got the same?
Yeah, I'm thinking probably that's about the same. But what happened was, because I needed to get to bed relatively early, because I was up at 5 o'clock yesterday morning to go to HRU. So I did the snow Sunday, maybe about 7 o'clock or so, 7:30. And in the morning when I came out, there was and I think there was probably a good 3 inches, 4 inches maybe on the ground. And then when I came out yesterday morning, I had to shovel the at least shovel my driveway and the steps. And I would say, you know, there was maybe another 3 inches, if not more. But, of course, some of that could have been blowing snow. So, I don't know. You know, 6 inches, 7 inches sounds about right for what we had. But I'm not looking forward to it now, because now the snow, of course, is a little harder. Jerry, I think you're fine, but have a good day. We'll talk to you later. Steve, this is KTKNB.
Wow, I haven't heard that in a long time. Steve, you remember those days when people didn't want to talk to you? They would say, I think you signed. Richie, that was pretty good. I got to commend you on that one. But I will sign so that you will not be made out to be a purveyor of terminological inexactitudes. 73, gentlemen. Steve?
Well, no subtlety loss on Jerry. I will say that, Rich.
Yeah, and I'm pretty certain he did say, I'll leave you two guys to talk. And that was the basis of my assumption. But, of course, you know what happens when you assume things. Anyway, But I do notice my voice. I it's like being multi-personality or something. I never know what voice is going to come up in the morning. I have no idea where this voice came from. WB2ZSE, K2KNB.
Well, perhaps you should go inside and have a little bit of tea and honey.
Yeah, but that's the problem. I don't know if this is actually my normal voice because it's been so many, many years with that higher pitch thing when the vocal cord goes south. So I'm really not sure what my voice is. Actually, because I'm inside now, maybe I should go outside and put some snow in my throat and see what happens.
Doesn't sound very pleasant. Just answering that, so I can. Anyway, I got to take a run over to Westbury, see what's going on there, and then attempt to go into the shop.
Well, I think they said the highways are pretty clear now. It looks like in my area, yesterday morning they hadn't gone down to Blacktop. I think by the time I came home yesterday, they had, and that's where I got Blacktop, but definitely icy spots there, too, so under any circumstances, be careful driving.
Yeah, I'm working on that.
Working on being careful driving?
Working on being careful on driving and, you know, just figuring out where I'm going.
Well, that you've been trying to do for years.
Yeah, let's go first. By the way, I assume you gave that Teflon cable a sniff and half. How do you like the shielding on that?
Well, again, I didn't cut into it. I left it the way it was, and I didn't cut any of the lanes because one of the things that I was trying to explain to people was generally how much you can bend a wire, and the rule of thumb that I've seen is about 20 times the diameter. So if something, you know, was a quarter inch, then you could bend it, I don't know, what is that, 20 quarters, I don't know, 5 inches, something like that. Is that right? No, bad math. Anyway, but so this way they had the whole length, and they could see why you would not use, let's say, a piece of 213 for a jumper, an 8-inch jumper, unless you were using right-angle connectors. But, you know, why you couldn't use it as a jumper between an antenna tuner and a radio. So, no, I left them the way they were, but I just like that wire. I forget, I've had some cables that I bought that use that because of the flexibility, not so much the double shielding that I was aware of.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I got a whole pile of it from a mutual friend of ours. They were replacing it with something else. I have a box of them.
Well, when I read the specs on it, I think it was 600 megahertz, 450 watts or something like that for that kind of cable. That's, you know, it's counterintuitive to what I would have normally thought.
It's probably 450 watts and 600 megahertz.
What did I say?
Said 600 watts at 450. I said 450 and 600, which is probably true.
I'm trying to think. I think actually when I looked it up on a chart, it was that 600 megs. Well, maybe, I don't know, 600 megs, 450 watts, something like that. You know, but anyway, one of the things that I would have emphasized is the size of the semiconductor. But it was interesting because one of the pictures that I use in the description is a piece of helix. So now they had a piece of helix, and the fact that there's no center conductor, you just have the outside, well, the metal tubing, whatever you would call the center conductor there. So it kind of explained the point about the flow of the electrons. Anyway, it was good. And I will keep those wires in my repertoire of good wires.
Okay. If I come up with anything else, I'll let you know. Somebody had suggested giving you a chunk of inch and 7/8, but I said you already had a piece of 4-inch wave guide.
Yeah, I think the piece that he gave me is actually the it's the 8-inch waveguide that was 72 ohms converted to 52 ohms. It's that really longer piece that they take samplings out of. The other one was an elbow, and I think they actually put that into the system. But the thing was, I didn't take that piece with me because with the conditions of the snow and you know, potential for ice, I just didn't want to be carrying it. It's probably a 24-inch section, and it weighs a lot, so I did end up leaving that home.
Okay, well, whatever works.
Yeah, but actually, as I'm thinking about it, not a bad idea for me to take put it down on its end and arrange a couple of other wires at their ends to show that as a comparison, and then I wouldn't have to bring it down with me every year because it is a heavy piece. Anyway, I learn. You know, every time I do that, I learn something new myself that I then can pass on, and I guess that's life in any event. WB2ZSE, KTKNB.
Yeah. I think I'll get off. Debating which way to go. I think I'll just take 107 south. WBCCSE. Somebody else here?
Oh, there's some noise like somebody trying to get in, but maybe on an HT or something. Anyway, let me think. I think I asked him a sign. I'll go, he can hear the cracking of my voice again there. So I think I'll go get some tea or something. All right, we'll catch you later. WB2ZSE, KTKNB.
Okay, Rich, I'll talk. And, it's that other thing I left you the message on is a little bit unusual, so let me know what you think. WB2ZSE.
At 8:30, WQVL repeater system. At 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. At 8:30, this is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.